This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Senate is debating cash for clunkers this week, and Detroit is keeping its fingers crossed because nothing sells cars like giving you money when you buy one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, everybody, the 3rd of August. Glad you could be with us. The monthly sales numbers that came out of Detroit today tell the story of what a smash cash for clunkers has been so far. Ford, GM, and Chrysler all reported sharply higher sales in July than they had in June. And even though they're still not selling as many cars as they were a year ago at this time, the Big Three is not going to turn its nose up at government-financed incentive programs. The Senate has till the end of this week when they go home for summer break to decide whether to put more money into cash for clunkers. $2 billion, plus or minus, is the figure being talked about. But no matter what does wind up happening in Washington, the deal is going to run out sometime, which does make one wonder how dealers are going to keep buyers coming into the showrooms when the money is gone. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
Nobody in the auto industry thinks cash for clunkers is going to save the business. Eric Merkel's a consultant to the industry. He says the program is a one-off. It attracted a different kind of driver.
So a lot of these people are folks that would probably not likely be new car buyers.
The automaker's regular customers upgrade their vehicles every few years. Their cars were less likely to qualify for the program. But Merkel says those buyers are the ones car makers are counting on.
And when the traditional new car buyer comes back in the market, and we also see recovery in fleet sales, we're going to see auto sales snap back pretty hard.
He doesn't think those buyers will be back until the end of this year, or maybe not until next. The money from cash for clunkers is tiding car companies over until that happens. Meanwhile, they're jockeying for position. George Augustitis follows the auto industry for consultant CSM Worldwide. He says they're trying everything from fuel-efficient cars to new marketing tactics.
Ford's putting as much product in the pipeline as they can. You know, Chrysler and GM are putting money in the hood. They're really trying to get financing.
None of that will matter unless the economy gets better and people get the credit they need to buy cars again. Gary Dilt from J.D. Power Automotive says cash for clunkers has given car makers a hand, but the industry's still in a terrible state.
Let's not pretend paradise is breaking out here. I mean, it's still an industry that's running at about an 11 million unit rate in the month of July. So it's not going to be too hard to see an industry better than that, even without a clunker program.
This week, the Senate will keep fighting it out over cash for clunkers. But Dilt says the auto industry is already moving on. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There was a report out today showing manufacturing is picking up. It's taking longer for plants to deliver their goods, and backlogs of orders are up, and that's a good thing. In fact, one key index of U.S. inventories now has recovered just about all the ground it lost during the worst of the recession. So maybe it's time for businesses to stop being so cautious and jump right back into that economy. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Picture the CEOs of the world as a crowd of marathon runners. They think they have the finish line in sight, and they're plotting their strategy down to the wire. What's the right moment to draw on precious resources, to borrow money and order new merchandise? Guess wrong, and Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says it might end up being a fatal mistake.
The danger is that in some industries, if you sort of stay in self-protect mode too long, you're going to miss the upturn completely and end up losing market share, more companies go broke in the upturn than they do during the recession.
Lee says some businesses have more leeway than others, and in any case, he doesn't think the right moment has arrived just yet.
You don't know if we're quite done with this or if we could get another little downturn. I think we're going to be bouncing along the bottom for a while. So I think you got time to take the jump. I don't think you have to rush.
At Yardeni Research, President Ed Yardeni says we all have a stake in the decision that businesses are struggling with now on when to stock up.
For them to increase their inventories, they're going to have to produce more, maybe even hire more, at least stop firing. And that could start to create a economic recovery. So in many ways, they're at a critical juncture for the economy. They can make or break the recovery.
The biggest complication remains still lagging consumer confidence numbers. Richard Hastings is consumer strategist for Global Hunter Securities. He expects retailers to hold out on holiday ordering as long as they can, literally down to the last minute.
They'll wait until really the bitter end. You're going to see an unusual scramble in the first 2 weeks of December to get a little more product in.
Economic predictions have, after all, been anything but an exact science during this monster recession. S&P economist David Weiss quoted Yogi Berra today. Predicting is difficult, especially about the future. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
As Bob just alluded to, timing is everything. Talk of the end of the recession means companies are calculating what to do with the size of their inventories and of their staffs. But there are still places that are trying to dig themselves out of this economic mess. Case in point, Jefferson County, Alabama. Over the weekend, Alabama's biggest county laid off nearly 1,000 employees, a quarter of its workforce, to deal with its budget problems. From WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, Tanya Ott reports.
It's a mess today in Jefferson County. People have been waiting in line for hours for driver's licenses and car tags. There aren't enough investigators to handle child abuse cases or enough building inspectors to approve new construction. Wes Gregory is a 12-year veteran of the county road department. He and his wife have a baby on the way, and he just got laid off.
I've just been trying to look for little small jobs that I can do here and there. Like if somebody needs their grass cut, that's fine. Hey, anything that'll bring in a little bit of money right now.
Jefferson County needs to trim a lot of money, $75 million, after a judge ruled a key tax illegal. The county also faces dwindling sales and property tax revenues, and that's put Alabama's largest county in financial crisis. Betty Fine Collins is president of the county commission.
When you serve in public office, nobody promises you a rose garden. Of course, I didn't know that we would wind up in some gothic situation here.
Commissioners' hands are tied. Under Alabama law, they can't pass new taxes. Only the state legislature can. And this spring, legislators squabbled over a fix. State Representative Patricia Todd says county commissioners haven't been much help.
They've come to one meeting we had. They were very defensive, and when we asked questions about things,
state lawmakers meet again this week to hammer out a compromise. In the meantime, nearly 1,000 county employees remain on unpaid administrative leave. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
Listeners who pay attention to those psychological thresholds they talk about on Wall Street a lot will be interested in the major indices today, 2 out of 3 of them anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hillary Clinton starts a trip to Africa today. 7 countries in 11 days. One of the 7 is South Africa. The Secretary of State will talk about the AIDS crisis there. She's also expected to promise American support for a wide range of other health initiatives. The South African government is trying to cut back on smoking-related diseases. Tobacco companies are cultivating millions of new smokers in Africa as the West cracks down on the habit. But activists in South Africa, who have had some success against international businesses during apartheid, are fighting back, as Gretchen Wilson reports.
At a construction site south of Johannesburg, Sibo Siso Mitshali takes a lunch break. As he comes off the site, the first thing he does is light a cigarette.
It's like if you are thirsty, you want to drink some water.
Mitshali knows the risks.
Smoking is not right. We kill ourselves. But if you want to relax, light your cigarette.
The World Health Organization says there are now 1 billion smokers around the world. More than 80% of them live in low- and middle-income countries like South Africa. Francois van der Merwe heads the Tobacco Institute of Southern Africa, a lobbying group for the industry.
Emerging markets, developing countries in the world, are growing markets for tobacco products.
Many African governments are trying to pass reforms aimed at reducing tobacco use. Yusuf Saluji heads South Africa's National Council Against Smoking. He says the tobacco companies have tried to stymie those reforms.
They've acted in South Africa the way they act all around the world, which is both bribing and bullying governments and trying to get them not to act.
He says the tobacco industry tries to cozy up to public officials with free cars or vacations and threatens the government with expensive lawsuits. But South Africa has largely resisted those tactics, making it an example for the developing world. When apartheid ended in 1994, the new government enacted a series of tobacco control laws. South Africa's roads used to be plastered with cigarette billboards. Not anymore, nor any other tobacco advertising. Smoking's banned in many public places. Brand new legislation ups the fines for selling cigarettes to minors. Back in 1994, about 33% of adults here smoked. Now that's down to 22%.
So not only has South Africa taken strong legislative action, but the actions have proven to work.
Farmers have grown tobacco in South Africa for centuries, and the tobacco industry here generates $1 billion in excise taxes every year, about 1% of government spending. Industry officials say tough legislation means governments lose that money, as sales are driven into an unregulated black market. Again, Francois van der Merwe of the Tobacco Institute.
Nobody can deny the massive economic impact of the tobacco industry in the world in terms of taxes, in terms of jobs, in terms of being good corporate citizens.
But anti-tobacco activists say that even in the region's poorest countries, like Malawi and Zambia, those lost taxes and jobs are nothing compared to what smoking-related diseases cost the public health systems. Kathy Mulvey is International Policy Director for Corporate Accountability International, a nonprofit group that fights for tougher tobacco laws around the world.
These are the countries that can least afford the burden of an entirely preventable epidemic. So it's a ticking time bomb of health and economic disaster.
She says even the countries with the strongest political will find it hard to go up against the vast resources of the big tobacco companies.
You know, what we're talking about are giant transnational corporations whose annual revenues eclipse the economies of many of these individual countries.
In South Africa, a company called British American Tobacco is the largest manufacturer and distributor of cigarettes. But it's now expanding its reach to friendlier shores. The global giant recently announced it would buy the fourth largest cigarette maker in Indonesia. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
More than half of all the workers in this country have some kind of retirement savings plan through their employer. Of course, you can look at that another way, too. That means about half of all workers don't have such a plan. Instead of leaving that half out in the cold, though, the Obama administration is considering a proposal to make it easier for people to save. The White House wants to require companies that don't offer 401ks to start and then to automatically deduct contributions from people's paychecks. It's being called an automatic IRA. Duke University behavioral economist Dan Ariely is back with us to discuss the pros and cons of required retirement planning. Dan, good to talk to you again.
Same here.
So how does this IRA proposal work then?
So here is the issue. Are people going to save enough by themselves, or do we need to force them into savings? And, you know, we used to have something like pension plans, what was called defined benefits, mm-hmm. that your workplace would put some money for you and you wouldn't have to think about it at all. And one day when you retire, you would have some money waiting for you. By the way, how is your workplace? Do they give you a defined benefit?
No, we get a 403B because we're a nonprofit and we get, you know, contributions from the company.
Okay.
So it's fairly standard.
So you put money and the company matches it.
Right.
Right. And it turns out that the vast majority of people don't max out this ability to save. And many people don't even save enough. In fact, a couple of researchers from Harvard showed that even people who are half a year from retirement, even those people that are giving up free money because they're not maxing the 401k or 403b contribution. So the new proposal is to take it out of people's hands. And instead of letting people decide, create what's called a default in which they will basically automatically save and people would have to fill some paperwork to get out of it.
So, in other words, you'd have to take some concrete action to not save, yes?
Right. And creating a default by which people are going to automatically save and they have to basically fill some paperwork to get out of it is going to be very effective in getting people to save more.
What is it about us that makes us not want to save, even in cases like 401ks and 403bs for nonprofits, where the corporate match, the company match, is in essence free money? Why don't more people see the benefit there and take advantage?
Well, the problem is really thinking long term. And the idea is that we're just not designed to think long term. I mean, think about what will happen 30 years from now. We're supposed to do all kinds of things to take care of our health. We're supposed to exercise. We're supposed to do all kinds of things that will pay off in the future but cost us in the present. And it turns out that evolutionarily, we're just not designed to do that.
Consider this in the present economic circumstance, though, the savings paradox, where everybody tells us we have to spend money to get this economy going again, but we have to save money because, frankly, things aren't so good. Doesn't this sort of hit right at the nub of that discussion?
Absolutely. You know, we are changing our habits. Americans are starting to save more. That's very good. But the fact is it will slow the recovery. But, you know, if you think about the benefits of increased saving as a habit, as something cultural that we all believe in, versus the disadvantages of a slow recovery, I think that the benefits of increased saving outweigh the cost, especially because I believe this will stay with us for a long time.
See, now that's interesting. I would not have figured that you, the behavioral economist, would have put that much faith in the American consumer, that we would keep on saving even when times get better.
Well, you see, that's an interesting thing. I have faith in habits, right? If people thought every time about the cost-benefit analysis, whether something is worthwhile or not, I think as the economy went back, people would not revise their decision. But because I believe that the way we make often decision is not to consider them actively, but in fact to rely on some habits, I think that creation of these new habits will basically keep with us for a long, long time.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book on the subject at hand is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, no little ones around makes it easier to spend big.
To raise a child today, at a minimum from birth to 18 before college, is between $100,000 and $200,000 per child. That's a lot of money that an individual without children can spend on themselves.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials raced up 114 points today, 1.25%, closed at 9,286. The NASDAQ posted a gain of 30 points, 1.5%, finished at 2,008. The S&P 500 climbed 15 points, 1.5%, clocked in at 1,002. It's the first time the index has cleared 1,000 this year. Cash for clunkers helped boost Ford sales about 2%. Wall Street, in turn, boosted Ford shares more than 4%. Investors also cheered reports that U.S. construction spending was up in June. Caterpillar, the maker of those big earth movers, it bulldozed its way to a gain of more than 2.33% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on what we earned and what we spent in June. A Senate Disaster Recovery Committee discusses evacuation planning and mental health recovery for children. And Barack Obama celebrates his first birthday as a White House resident. The president will be 48. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today, the White House was looking ahead to what's going to be the big economic story come Friday morning. That would be the July unemployment numbers. Echoing the conventional wisdom, the White House press office said it's sure several hundred thousand more jobs will be lost before the economy recovers. There are actually some worries it may be more than several hundred thousand jobs lost, and then what we'll wind up having is a jobless recovery. Commentator Amelia Tiagi says a government agency we all love to hate might be a contributing factor if that does wind up happening.
The workforce is changing, probably forever. Gone is the 25-year career and the predictable 9-to-5 routine. Contractors, temps, consultants, and virtual offices are as commonplace as iPhones. We've known this for a while, but the jobless recovery may bring it into sharper focus. Business is starting to pick up, but companies are skittish about committing to long-term hires. Many are looking to contractors to fill the gap. This is pretty much old news to everyone except the IRS. According to the tax code, there are exactly two types of workers. Either you're an employee, fixed at one company, working an eight-hour day, getting benefits and a regular paycheck. Or you're an independent business person, running your own company and setting your own hours. Sounds simple, right? But today there are millions of people who work in the gray zones in between. This isn't just a bit of arcane tax law. If a business mislabels an employee as a contractor, when the IRS says otherwise, the business stands to bear substantial penalties. I understand that many Americans are worried about the trend away from steady, long-term employment. But the IRS can't reverse that trend. And they may be making things worse when an already skittish company decides that they're better off not hiring any employees or contractors, or opts to use them for shorter periods, just to be on the safe side with a confusing tax code. If you think the line between contractor and employee is a clear one, guess again. Consider the computer programmer who works from home. Maybe he shifts from job to job every few months. Suppose he takes a long weekend at the beach and then works 15 hours the next day. If the tax code calls him a contractor, it's no problem. But if he's an employee, he's probably due overtime pay, which can be a big problem. It's time for the IRS to adapt the tax code to a reality we've been living with for decades. The at-home programmers, the consultants, the interim execs for hire, and a host of other new job categories are here to stay, and they deserve a real designation in the tax code. It's time for some sensible shades of gray.
Amelia Tiagi is a co-founder of the Business Talent Group. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The economy has started getting better. We got that much from the gross domestic product report this past Friday morning. GDP is not shrinking as fast as it was. Still, it's going to be a while before a lot of consumers start feeling really good about things and then start spending again. I'm thinking here about consumers like me who have kids to help them burn through a paycheck. There is, though, a huge chunk of the population without kids, and many of them have been experiencing the recession in a very different way. Advertisers call them dinks, double incomes, no kids. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
If you want to get an idea how dinks spend their money during a recession, where do you go? Maybe Times Square? They've got all kinds of people there and all kinds of pricey diversions. Yvonne and Rick Yu are visiting from Toronto. They have no kids and they're spending like it's, well, 2007.
Well, I think we're just still young, so we can just kind of do whatever we want to do right now and just be free to see whatever we want to see.
Same story for Rebecca Lopez and her boyfriend. She says she wouldn't have flown from Spain to take in New York's tourist attractions if she had kids.
We are free. We are not married, but we are a couple for years. But we don't have children, and it changed everything.
It sure does, according to Wes Combs of the marketing firm Whittick Combs Communications.
To raise a child today, at a minimum from birth to 18 before college, is between $100,000 and $200,000 per child. That's a lot of money that an individual without children can spend on themselves.
Combs says one of the best ways to get an idea what dinks are doing is to look at gays and lesbians. Sure, some gay couples have kids, but there are still plenty that don't.
They're more confident about what's going on right now and what they're seeing. And there's also some additional evidence to show that they're spending more when they go out, specifically with travel.
Combs' firm conducted a survey recently that found 62% of gays plan to maintain or increase their travel budgets this year. To find out for myself, I hopped on a bus to the gay mecca of Provincetown, Massachusetts.
Looking for hungry people. Bayside Betsy's has lots of food and it ain't gonna eat itself.
It's just after noon on a hot, sunny day. On P-Town's main strip, Commercial Street, the barkers are out, and so are the spenders, like partners Larry Walsh and John Buchan from Peoria, Illinois.
We're doing our stimulus package for P-Town.
And what are you doing today?
Today we're going shopping again. We're shopping today, and then we're going to the pool later on, and then we're going out to dinner.
If you're looking for a place to stay the night in Provincetown, good luck. No vacancy signs are more prevalent than the for lease signs on the storefronts back in New York. Howard Wiener runs a guest house called Howard's End. How many rooms are vacant right now?
None.
It's totally full.
Yeah.
Now, Wiener says business is still off about 20% from last year, but not among couples, both gay and straight, without kids.
They're spending pretty much the same thing. Of course, gays will spend more on drinks, on liquor, and at the clubs than straight couples will. That is definitely for sure.
If there's one place where the money in P-Town drains like the tide, it's the boat slip. Patrons sip down $10 drinks before an evening of entertainment. Mark Sam Rosenthal's trying to lure an audience for his one-man drag show. Blanche survives Katrina in a FEMA trailer named Desire. I asked him if the crowds have been indicative of the greatest recession since the Great Depression.
No, but I wasn't here for that one. I'm not that old. I hear that it's worse than last summer, but I don't see the greatest difference, whatever you said.
Neither do companies that are taking advantage of dinks, whether they're gay or straight. Again, here's marketing consultant Wes Combs.
They understand this unique element that this segment, while other parts of the economy are going down, is more likely to spend right now. So they're making sure that they target those dollars, the limited dollars they have for advertising, at a minimum on this market.
Combs says those dollars will be well spent because so far, dinks are behaving as though this recession has been dinky. In Provincetown, Massachusetts, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, there are 32,741 post offices spread across this country. Told you that so I could tell you this. Come the end of the fiscal year, a post office near you could be out of business. The Postal Service came face-to-face with its $7 billion budget deficit today. Officials said they might request permission to close up to 1,000 local branches. The Independent Postal Regulatory Commission, the same folks who get to say how much stamps cost, are going to get to decide this one. Last week, the Government Accountability Office put the Postal Service on its list of troubled federal agencies. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 114 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ bulked up 30 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 added 15 points, also 1.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, in the UK, a slippery climb up the social ladder.
If they're graduating with £50,000, £60,000, £70,000 worth of debt, that is an astronomical figure to them when their family income may be a fraction of that.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.